Roman Catholicism, A Threat to Liberty. Last year, 1988, as you know, marked the 400th anniversary of the Spanish Armada and the 300th anniversary of the Glorious Revolution. Both these events are of supreme importance as far as our nation's history is concerned. Both of them came about, we believe, as a result of divine intervention, and we were rescued as a land out of the hands of our enemies just when they thought that victory was within their grasp. The machinations of Romanists were brought to nothing, and as a result, our religious and civil liberties were secured. At the beginning of 1689, exactly 300 years ago, the Bill of Rights was drawn up together with the Act of Succession, and these are at the very heart of our nation's constitution, and indeed the only part of it which is written. What the Covenanters fought, bled, and died for was to a great extent achieved. The Revolution settlement had its shortcomings, but it left in no doubt the Protestantism of our nation, and it can be justly claimed that it was the contendings of faithful men such as Richard Cameron, Donald Cargill, and James Fenwick, and their followers that secured it. And we have certainly reason to remember them with gratitude to the God who raised them up and made them in their day valiant for the truth on the earth. It provided for the upholding of all laws made against popery and papists, and for the maintenance of the Reformed Protestant religion. It also established anew, as far as Scotland was concerned, the Presbyterian Church government and discipline as being, quote, agreeable to the Word of God and most conducive to the advancement of true piety and godliness, end quote. The wording of the Bill of Rights and Act of Settlement is very clear and explicit as far as the British monarchy is concerned. Here it is, and whereas it has been found by experience that it is inconsistent with the safety and welfare of this Protestant kingdom to be governed by a popish prince or by any king or queen marrying a papist, every person who is or shall be reconciled to or shall hold communion with the see or church of Rome, or shall profess the popish religion, or shall marry a papist, shall be excluded and be forever incapable to inherit, possess, or enjoy the crown or government of this realm and Ireland. And in every such case, the people of these realms shall be and are hereby released of their allegiance. One would think that in view of the foregoing, any commemoration of the Bill of Rights by the British Parliament would draw attention to its historical background. But to our knowledge, neither of the loyal addresses presented last year to Her Majesty the Queen by the Lords and Commons, respectively, mentioned the inglorious role of the Roman Catholic Church at all. Romanists must not be offended, it would seem, that the ecumenical boat must not be rocked. This nation had certainly learned by experience that Romanism and civil and religious liberties were not compatible. In the words of Adam Smith, the author of The Wealth of Nations, quote, "The Constitution of the Church of Rome may be considered the most formidable combination that was ever formed against the authority and security of civil government, as well as against the liberty, reason, and happiness of mankind," end quote. And both before his time and since, there has been ample evidence to support this affirmation. The anti-Christian system we call Romanism, at the head of which is the man of sin and sin of perdition, is delineated in Scripture as coming on the scene after the working of Satan. And if this be the Spirit's masterpiece, according to Calvin, Christ is opposed and supplanted in all his offices. The Pope of Rome proclaims himself to be the King of Nations and King of Saints, claiming preeminence not just in the Church, but in the State also. The term Antichrist means not just against Christ, but in place of Christ. It means in English Vice Christ or Vicar of Christ, which is in fact one of the many titles the Pope lays claim to. He claims to act in his name, but is in truth his rival and greatest enemy. That he was a usurper of Christ's prerogatives was well understood by our covenanting forefathers. In subscribing the covenant, they were declaring, quote, "We detest and refuse the usurped authority of that Roman Antichrist," end quote. In the year 800, Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne Holy Roman Emperor, and that coronation made the popes think that they had the power and right to enthrone and depose monarchs at their will and pleasure. Two famous documents Houghton tells us in his sketches from church history, both of them forgeries, further assisted the growth of the power of the papacy. The so-called Donation of Constantine claimed that the emperor of that name had granted the bishops of Rome very extensive rights in Italy, including the privilege of wearing a golden crown. Later documents called decretals, professing to be letters and decrees of bishops of Rome going back to apostolic days, exhausted the powers of the church in general and assisted the bishops of Rome to establish their authority in both church and state. By 1073, the Pope's claim to supremacy over church and state was made good by Hildebrand. He came into conflict with Henry IV, the Holy Roman Emperor, who lived in Germany. And when Henry disregarded papal decrees, a sentence of interdict was pronounced against his subjects. Henry IV had finally to give in, and in midwinter came to Canossa to humbly acknowledge papal supremacy. For 3 days in the cold and snow of winter, barefoot and in the white garment of a penitent, he was kept waiting for the Pope to grant him permission to kneel at his feet and ask forgiveness. On the fourth day, he consented to receive him. It was Hildebrand who said, quote, "We desire to show the world that we can give or take away at our will kingdoms, duchies, earldoms, in a word, the possessions of all men, for we can bind or loose," unquote. The principle was established. The state is subservient to the church, and that remains one of the foundation principles of Roman Catholicism. That is one reason why it is such a threat to the authority and security of civil government, as well as against the liberty, reason, and happiness of mankind. The existence of this threat was clearly set forth in the famous papal encyclical and syllabus of 1864. The following principles, among others, were declared to be those of the Roman Catholic Church, all of them binding upon Roman Catholics. 1. The people are not the source of civil power. 2. The Church has the right to exercise its authority without having any limit set to it by the civil power. 3. the church has the right to avail itself of force and to use the temporal power for that purpose. For the church has an innate and legitimate right to acquire, hold, and to use property without limit. 5. The Pope and the priests ought to have dominion over temporal affairs. 6. The church and her ecclesiastics have a right to immunity and civil law. 7. The clergy should be tried for civil and criminal offences only in ecclesiastical courts. 8. In case of conflict between the ecclesiastical and civil powers, the ecclesiastical power ought to prevail. 9. The civil power is inferior and subordinate to the ecclesiastical power, and in litigated questions of jurisdiction should yield to it. More than that, it must remain Roman Catholic teaching that monarchs deposed by the Pope may be killed by the first to reach them. If the public cause, and I'm quoting, that is Rome's view, if the public cause cannot find its defense in the public death of a tyrant, that is, one refusing to accept papal supremacy and depose, it is lawful for the first comer to assassinate him. It was promulgated at the 1870 Vatican Council that all heretics and all who deny the Pope's universal authority and all who harbor the least doubt of any point which has been decreed by a Pope are ipso facto excommunicated. An 18th century Roman Catholic moral theologian taught that, quote, a man who has been excommunicated by the Pope may be killed anywhere, because the Pope has an indirect jurisdiction over the whole world in temporal things. Unquote. Cardinal Bellarmine thus expounded the doctrine of the Roman Church. Quote, the Pope can, if expedient for the Church, alter the positive precepts of the apostles. Unquote. And so, for his own advantage, he changed the sin of murder into a righteous and praiseworthy act. All this is a somewhat familiar ring about it. The Ayatollah Khomeini has decreed that Salman Rushdie is a heretic to be assassinated, and the assassin is assured of a place in paradise. Of course, everyone is appalled, and diplomatic relations are broken off with such a tyrant. But is the Pope of Rome any different? Has he repudiated the actions and statements of past popes? The Pope decreed in his own infallibility in 1870. That decree is retrospective. It declares all sentences of former popes spoken ex cathedra were infallible and are still binding on the consciences of men. Accordingly, sentences of excommunication passed by former popes against sovereigns of the past are still as valid in conscience as they were when first given. The Roman Catholic Church may not openly press these claims nowadays, but that is because it is not expedient to do so. It is not because they are not still held. Remember, Semper Eadem is still her motto. When it is possible for her to do so, she puts them into practice. Thus, she availed herself of force in coming to the Waldensian valleys and over several centuries persecuted to the death those who maintained a witness to the truth of the gospel in that part of Europe. Cromwell threatened to intervene with military action, and the threat was sufficient to ease the strain. Milton wrote his famous sonnet at that time and expressed in imperishable verse the indignation felt in Protestant Britain. Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saints, whose bones lie scattered on the Alpine mountains cold, even them who kept thy faith so pure of old, when all our fathers worshipped stocks and stones. Forget not. In thy book record their groans to wear thy sheep, and in their ancient fold, slain by the bloody Piedmontese that rolled mother with infant down the rocks, their moans the veil to double to the hills and there to heaven, their martyred blood and ashes sow o'er all the Italian fields, where still doth sway the triple tyrant, that from these may grow a hundredfold, who, having learned thy way, early may fly the Babylonian woe. Who is able to estimate the number that suffered since the Counter-Reformation was set in motion? The 30 Years' War took its toll. The Inquisition slew its thousands upon thousands. Multitudes perished in the Netherlands under the murderous reign of the Duke of Alva. The massacre of St. Bartholomew springs to mind, as also does the 1641 horrific massacre of Irish Protestants. The attempts made to restore Roman Catholicism in England and Scotland led to the loss of many lives. Protestantism had successfully undermined the political power of the papacy. A nation such as our own denied outright the vital claim of the Roman Catholic Church to be, by divine right, superior to all other forms of government. The papal-controlled confederation of European states was broken up by the Reformation, and Rome's aim since has been to re-establish the political and social order of pre-Reformation times. Claims that both world wars were brought about through Jesuit intrigue and with a view to restoring again some sort of Holy Roman Empire are well documented. The subjugation of Britain remains a prime priority. Where heresy, that is Protestantism, conquered in England, that is Britain, it would be conquered throughout the world, was the view of Cardinal Manning in 1859 as he encouraged his troops at the time. And it is very clear that Rome has been directing her forces accordingly. In the event, the attempt to form this new Holy Roman Empire by force of arms failed with the defeat of Germany in 1945. It is not to be forgotten that Hitler, Goebbels, Himmler, as well as most of the Nazi party, were Roman Catholics. Goebbels acquired his skills as a ruthless and principled propagandist from Jesuit teachers, and Himmler organized the SS according to the principles of the Jesuit order. The attempt, however, has not been abandoned. Hence the Treaty of Rome and the creation of the EEC, bringing about the breaking down of the barriers between nations and making it necessary for them to be interdependent for economic survival. No one knows the extent of the Vatican's financial involvement, but it is estimated to be massive, so massive that it may come to the point that no member nation can afford to offend the papacy. The nations of Europe appear to be fast becoming puppets, with the Church of Rome pulling all the strings. She is exerting her influence by means of officers planted in all state departments, and members occupying places of authority, with public opinion molded by the mass media in her favor. She is served by a host of troops who work under all sorts of names, in all places and disguises: reporters, writers for the press, preachers in the pulpit and occupants of professorial chairs at universities. In 1992, the European Community Free Trade Act becomes operative, and a great step will have been taken towards the formation of the USE, the United States of Europe, or another Holy Roman Empire as we view it. The Pope's appearance in Strasbourg to address the European Parliament and the political nature of his speech is a clear indication to us of the way things are going. Our national sovereignty is almost completely eroded, and the Westminster Parliament's role in governing our nation is being increasingly restricted as power and influence comes more and more to be exercised across the Channel. Rome has plotted for centuries to present Great Britain to the Virgin Mary, that is, the Queen of Heaven, patron saint of the European community, as her dowry. With an economic stranglehold exerted and the Church of England almost within the fold and apathy reigning to the extent that it is, it must now appear to her strategists that they have not labored in vain. What the Jesuits have worked for centuries and failed to accomplish by two world wars will, if the Lord prevent it not, have been achieved. But Rome has a greater ambition than the establishment of a Holy Roman Empire in Europe. She is aiming for a world order of states, a sort of pyramid of states, from the apex of which the Roman Catholic Church will exercise totalitarian rule, with the Pope of Rome as the so-called Vicar of Christ and acknowledged to be the mouthpiece of God. Some, of course, will maintain that the Roman Catholic Church does not, in 1989, pose a threat to our civil and religious liberties. But that, of course, is exactly the impression that the Roman Catholic Church and hierarchy desire to convey. We emphasize hierarchy and priesthood, not the ordinary Roman Catholic who happens to be our neighbor, fellow worker, or fellow student. Any changes that have taken place in Rome's recent times have been cosmetic, on the surface only. There has been no retreat. The doctrine of transubstantiation remains what it was, and it was for the denial of that doctrine that many martyrs were burned. If infallibility is claimed, then for Rome to speak of real change, or the necessity of any real change, would be contradictory and self-destructive. The Bible does not speak of any reforming of the Roman Catholic Church. It speaks of its destruction. Protestants in Ulster are left in no doubt as to the threat posed to their civil and religious liberties by Roman Catholicism. The IRA are Roman Catholic to a man. Bobby Sands, who died as a hunger striker in the Mayor's prison, was visited by a special emissary from the Pope and presented with a golden crucifix before he died. The Pope, on his visit to Ireland, flatly refused to excommunicate the IRA. "No, no, no," he said. IRA terrorist atrocities might well be regarded as praiseworthy. The principle that the state is subservient to the Church is embodied in the Irish Constitution and the non-arrest of Paddy Ryan, a Roman Catholic priest wanted in connection with IRA atrocities, ought not to have surprised anyone familiar with the principles of Roman Catholicism. That priest was above the law, not subject to it. So also was Michael Collins, a notorious IRA terrorist, shot dead in 1922. He and his colleagues were also working heart and soul for the downfall of Britain. Make no mistake about it. If Roman Catholicism comes into the ascendancy, its very principles put into practice will require that all will have to be subject to her authority or suffer the consequences. Rome will offer no alternative to absolute submission. In education, which affects many of you, this is what Rome believes. Quote, "The rights of the Roman Catholic Church in the teaching of youth comes before the rights of the state," end quote. And that statement came from the lips of Pope John the 23rd in the year 1959. Again, quote, "Catholics cannot approve of a system of education for youth apart from the Catholic faith and disjoined from the authority of the Church," end quote. The Education Act of 1918 allowed the Roman Catholic Church to have the best of both worlds, separate schools but state-funded. She has not been slow to take advantage of this. When local authority reorganization took place some 15 years ago, the first draft of the bill to be placed before Parliament gave a statutory right to the Roman Catholic Church and to that body alone to be represented on education committees. The other churches in Scotland protested, and the Church of Scotland was then given a statutory right to be also represented, with representatives from the remaining churches to be appointed or elected according to circumstances. The impression given was that the Roman Catholic Church was a national church, and its faith the true faith. Another more recent attempt to give prominence to the Church and its teaching was the proposal in the syllabus for the SCE standard grade examination in religious studies to make it compulsory to study Christianity. But Christianity, quote, "in relation to the Roman Catholic tradition," end quote. There has been some backtracking on this after protests, but the position still remains most unsatisfactory. This again indicates how great an influence the Roman Catholic Church has on those responsible for drafting new legislation. Woe betide us if the Westminster Parliament comes to be dominated by Romanists, or if its authority is undermined to the extent that all legislation will be enacted in Strasbourg by a Parliament already packed with Roman Catholics. Roman Catholicism requires that allegiance to the Pope and Church comes first, and after that, that which may be due to one's nation and monarch. Devout Roman Catholics are thus, in effect, self-disabled as far as rendering and divided allegiance to the Queen is concerned, and should therefore be regarded as not fit to hold office under the crown. Our Church has an honored history as far as witnessing against Roman Catholicism is concerned. Much depends on you if that witness is to be continued into the future. We cannot afford to be complacent. We said that there is to be no reformation of the Roman Catholic Church, but destruction. We are sure that the whole system is to fall, because the Bible tells us so. When Christ's set time comes, he will consume the man of sin by the breath of his mouth and destroy him with the brightness of his coming. And we are to look to him and be encouraged to trust him to fulfill his own word. I shall now finish with a quotation from the famous English poet William Cowper. And I discovered this quotation while turning the pages of the Dictionary of Quotations. Here it is. Rome shall perish. Write that word in the blood that he has spilt.